This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your no other shade of blue but you of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I've been having a hard time adjusting. I had the shiniest wheels, now they're rusting. I didn't know if you'd care if I came back. I have a lot of regrets about that. Pulled the car off the road to the lookout. Could have followed my fears all the way down. And maybe I don't quite know what to say, but I'm here in your doorway. I just wanted you to know.
As promised, TS2, the sequel, Electric Boogaloo, Folklore Popcast. We are back. We have listener questions. We've got listener emails. I've got a cut and paste document overflowing with rich context, desperate questions that we are going to answer. We only got to a couple of them last week, but that's why we had to come back with another full episode to add texture to our conversation. We've got a new gang with us this week. So last week we had JP, Joe, and Karen. This week we're bringing in the heavy hitters. Lindsay Zolaz is here. Lauren Michelle Jackson is here. And we are going to go deep on all of your questions about Taylor, about genre, about Bon Iver, about Dessner, about Antonoff. There's even a Justin Timberlake question in here. You know, it's a lot of primary and also secondary and tertiary information that we're going to get into. So without further ado, we are jumping in TS2 Folklore Popcast Extravaganza. First, you know, we have Lindsay Zolaz. Lindsay is a music critic for us and for many other places. Lindsay, hello. Welcome. Welcome to the trees. Folklore is here. How you doing? You good?
I'm all right.
Phenomenal. Lindsay, no stranger to podcasts. First time on podcast. Hello, Lauren Michelle Jackson. What's really good? How are you?
Hi, honored to be here.
I'm very excited. So first of all, y'all know Lindsay, but let me just talk about Lauren for a second. So first of all, follow Lauren on Twitter. Super, super solid. Lauren is a professor at Northwestern. Lauren wrote a book called White Negroes. It's an essay collection. It's about cultural appropriation. But I know from following Lauren on Twitter that she is also a Swiftie, a grade A Swiftie. And you tweeted something, maybe you want to share for the people, something that you had tweeted and then I think retweeted into your feed during the Folklore release. Do you know the thing I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. So this was like a tweet from, I feel like it was like a couple of years ago now. And what's funny is the tweet that I was quoting, like, I think that person like deleted the original tweet. So it always seems like my response was like super like salty or something like that. But really, I think the question was just like, what is like a music take that like you would stand by just like no matter what? And mine was that Taylor Swift has never written a bad song ever.
Ever. And then you retweeted it, which means that you listen to Folklore and you continue to agree with that.
Yes. I said, still I rise.
Yeah. Okay. That is a very laden approach to say, to use that phrase, but great. We're going to go in on it. Lindsay, before we get into the micro, where are you at on Folklore? You have not written about it. This is untrammeled territory. We are getting fresh opinions from you.
Exclusive.
Yes.
Right here.
Strictly podcast exclusives. You know how we do. This is a take you will not get anywhere else. Go.
I really love about a third of this album.
Ooh, okay.
And then,
well, me too. Well, funnily enough, me too.
Yeah. And probably really like another third and then cannot connect with the other. Not that it's like cut into thirds in any meaningful way, but we'll get there.
To what it's also like 16 like. Songs, I'm, which is I'm not divisible little, by three, just for the record.
It's true. I am sort of mixed on it. I do feel like it's an interesting and sort of necessary step for her, mm-hmm. but it feels transitional to me and possibly exciting about what it like points towards in the future. But I don't think it's like one of her strongest records to me.
That's more or less what I think. But I actually, that's a really good transition to the first question that I wanted to ask, which is actually, the question is sort of aimed at me, but it's, I think we can all answer a version of this question. So this is from Courtney Fisher. Courtney Fisher says, on the Reputation podcast, I believe you made the argument that musically, the jump from Red to 1989 was bigger than the jump from 1989 to Reputation. Now that we have two more albums to compare, where would you add the jump from Reputation to Lover and the jump from Lover to Folklore in that ranking?
Mm.
Now, to your point about the necessariness of it, you know, I have a feeling we are going to circle back to the Joni Mitchell question, which we brought up last week and sort of has been a recurring theme of Taylor meta-analysis that we've been engaging in. But I will jump in and say something along the lines of Folklore does feel midway to me, to something. And we touched on this a little bit last week. Because it happens so fast, it doesn't necessarily 100% feel like a fully realized idea to me, but it does feel midway as a transitional point away from what's been happening, especially in the Reputation into Lover era. So I think this leap is probably a little bit bigger than those. It's probably more akin in reverse to the Red to 1989 leap, in my opinion. What do you guys think?
That's really interesting, because I was actually almost going to say like kind of the opposite, which is like, I think actually that transitional quality is why it doesn't feel like as much of a leap. It's kind of like, oh, I'm trying a thing, and like it doesn't completely necessarily like curl all the way over entirely throughout the album. But I think because of that, it does. And I think even like Lover has some of that quality of like trying. Which is like no shade or anything like that.
But it's shade is okay if that's where you're going to. It's okay. Safe space.
I know, but you know, I do think because of the maybe trying isn't the word, maybe like hesitancy or like something about it, I think puts those two in a more sort of like seamless line to me than maybe the leaps from earlier albums.
I think, so what's exciting about this move to me with Taylor is, you know, we talk all the time about how tethered to kind of like the old fashioned album release she still has been, even in an era where big produced, you know, finely sequenced pop albums don't necessarily have the same currency. And a lot of who we would consider like her superstar peers are not really working in that lane anymore. I like that this is her, it feels like the first step of getting away from that presentation of her work, but at the same time, it's still an album of 16 songs that's over an hour and feels like a fully realized thing. So I think it's transitional to me in that way, that she's never going to be like, well, I never want to say never with her now, but I think, you know, comparing her to Drake in a lot of ways is interesting and kind of, I think she is, there are peers more than Taylor and Kanye, which we can, you know, actually not to mention whose name I shouldn't have spoken.
He who shall not be named, at least not for another 20 minutes or so.
I'll try my best. What is exciting to me more than necessarily like the music on this record, which I do think there are some really great songs and we can get into that. I look forward to her stepping away from the idea that this fully packaged album with the hints about what the title is going to be and the rollout and the color scheme and everything like that. I feel like this is a step away from that that I was wanting her to take for a while, and that I do think frees her up to do more interesting and even like less ambitious things in the future. Like, I would love for her to just put out an EP or something like that, or
a covers EP,
I think it's her, you know, she said in that statement that she put out, like, it is her sort of at least presenting the idea that she's moving away from that perfectionist idea of like everything that she has to put out is super polished and thought through and has like the multi-platform rollout and corporate sponsorship and all that. And, you know, this is not, we'll get to why this is not necessarily like a quote unquote indie album too, which part of that conversation is driving me crazy. But I think that this is like her version of stepping away from the way she has presented her songs in the past. And that's interesting to me and makes me kind of excited about, you know, what happens next.
It, well, but it is kind of funny that like her version of stepping away still includes like a cardigan for sale.
Yes, that's like literally exactly what I was going to say. Yeah,
the cardigan, or like, I mean, I was even like looking at the merch because like, I don't know, whatever. I buy merch sometimes. Who knows?
Hey.
And it was just like, I was like, all of it is like so ugly. I was like, I want the shirt you're wearing in that like fifth or seventh like album cover that like, and again, like, you know, there's this limited release of, you know, different album covers, but I was like, I want that shirt and that like Oxford shoe. I don't want this like ugly t-shirt that's like the folklore t-shirt. And it's like, why is it the folklore album? Like, it's just, it's folklore.
Folklore. And yeah, I, this is a sort of consistent issue, I think, with Taylor, which is that the merch is just does not, it's not hitting. Like, it just does not hit. And I feel, and I own a couple of rare pieces of Taylor merch. I have like a great red era Taylor, I guess like a football jersey or something. Like, you know, like I have some key pieces over the years. I've held on to some key pieces. But like the kind of the late era Taylor merch is just generally not hitting.
She should re-release the Not a Lot Going On at the Moment tee from the 22 video, because that's how I feel right now. And I would wear that. I would wear that.
Major.
Absolutely.
Well, anyway, free merch ideas for anybody listening who works with Taylor Swift.
Wait, I have one more. Can I share my other merch?
Oh, yeah, yeah, you had. Yeah, you go in.
Very. I think that I would also wear a shirt, a yellow shirt, little scoop neck that says, "No, it's Betty." I know you guys get it because you're the real heads now.
Oh, no.
Speak on it for everybody who doesn't get it.
So Taylor Swift's sort of first acknowledgement of the internet, I think we could say, or like her first, not her first, her acknowledgement of like being a meme was to wear a t-shirt that said, "No, it's Becky," in reference to a meme that found, what, a yearbook photo of some girl who looked like young Taylor Swift, but was actually Becky.
Did she like allegedly like pass away from like weed overdose or something? Like, no. Like, not the person, but it's just like, it was the joke that was like associated with the Tumblr post. And it's just like, maybe I made that up. That just got really dark. But like,
knowyourmeme.com, look it up.
It's just like, I remember there's like some like ridiculous story attached to it.
So again, more free merch ideas for anybody who happens to be listening. On podcast, first of all, go back and listen to the merch episode, which is actually a really, really good episode. But also, we are always here for merch on podcast, which is why when there is struggle merch, we want to speak on it. Same way we want to speak when there are struggle albums. Just putting that out there. Next question, sort of related to the last question. If this album, this is from Callie Wells. If this album had come directly after Reputation, so No Lover, would the reception have been the same?
I'm answering every one of these with like an audible I realize too. I think that it would not have been. I think that's a very good question.
Yeah, I agree.
I also want to stake my claim of, I really like Lover, and I think that is the record of hers that's grown on me the most of the last few. I still can't really connect with most of Reputation, although I think there are some very good songs on it. But Lover is something like I still listen to a lot. I find myself going back to it and kind of like changing my opinions on certain songs. So I'm still very much Lover Hive in my life still. But I also kind of think it was something that she needed to do before something like this to get away from the response of Reputation. And I do think it just like, you know, the goodwill that she built up both from that record, and also I think the Netflix documentary ended up being a really good move for her, and this sort of narrative correction that also seem to stick. We can talk about all the political things she's done in the meantime, but there was a buildup to people who had been very quick to criticize her or dismiss her in the past were already kind of softening up. And I think a lot of the reception of this record has to do with what came before, directly before either. I think this could have been seen as like very calculated or facetious if it was right after Reputation, because that's how people thought that record was.
Should we listen to a song off of Reputation, which feels like it came out 19 years ago?
Oh my God. Yeah. Which one?
I would love to.
Let's do something like non-intuitive. Like maybe I Did Something Bad.
Sure.
Sure.
Let's listen to I Did Something Bad from Reputation by Taylor Swift. So here's my answer to the previous question, which is I don't know if the response to this record would have been different if it came out directly after Reputation, but I think it would have colored how people think about Reputation. And Reputation is already an album that has a bit of a fraught public absorption. For anybody ratioing me on Twitter, like, people forget very quickly I was one of the critics that was like loudest in favor of Reputation. So I remember how much kind of visceral pushback there was to Reputation, especially from critics. And I think if the record, this record, or a record very much like this, had come out right after Reputation, it would have weakened whatever case could have been made for Reputation in kind of retrospect, because it would have seemed like such an aggressive course correction that it would have felt like Reputation was something that Taylor was running from.
That's why I think like some of the worst responses to Folklore, and I mean that on the side of people who are both like in favor of it and also like are, well, I actually really mean this for people who are like really, really super in favor of it. I do think like those responses would actually be more intense if this album had directly followed Reputation. I think it would have allowed people to place Taylor on this like, you know, sort of common pop narrative that we have where it's like you do something really brash and bombastic and then you go back to your roots, right? The Miley Cyrus story, the Christina Aguilera story, et cetera, the Man in the Woods story, right? Is it even Man in the Woods or Man of the Woods? Like, who even knows?
Well, we actually have a question like about that album. So when you're done, I'm going to ask that question. So keep going, because I'm so glad this is the road you're walking down.
I think like if it had followed Reputation, I think it's a really good point Lindsay makes that like people need to chill. Like, I think there are a lot of people who maybe even didn't listen to Lover just because they were like, and especially like the singles on that album, it was very, you know, I don't think they were that representative of like what the album actually sounds like. So like, I think people needed like a little bit of a break, and then maybe they can be more receptive to Folklore. And so those people, I think if Folklore had come right after, like it would have felt incredibly gimmicky. But I also think a lot of her most like hardcore fans would have been like, if it's possible to imagine them being more annoying than they are right now, would have been like even more intensely enthusiastic in a way that wouldn't actually allow for people to talk about the things that Folklore is very strong on and the things that it's, you know, weaker on.
The narrative, even before Reputation, was always just like, Taylor Swift is oversaturated in the media. Like, she needs to take a year off. We need some time away from her. And now, cut to now, and it's like, yes, it's only been like 11 months since her last album, and here's more music. Like, people can't get enough of her now. And it does feel really, so much has changed about her perception, the perception of her in the pop world in the past like 4 or 5 years, that it just feels like a total 180 from feeling like you couldn't get away from her to now people feeling like they can't get enough.
I also think that has to do with where Taylor sits in like the full pop troposphere during normal times, and then during a moment like this where we're all basically kind of trapped in the house or some version of that. there was a thing that was happening in 2016, 2017, 2018, where Taylor was getting to a level where she was altering her production choices. She was altering some of her subject matter in order to, I don't know if compete is exactly the right word, but it's to sort of put on the character of the kind of world-killing global pop star. But as much as I like a lot of those songs, I'm not convinced that's ever really been 100% where her strengths lie. And so I think part of the reason that annoyance that you sort of refer to, Lindsay, obviously Taylor's been met with skepticism at every stage of her career from different groups of people, different sets of people being like, hey, you know, not on my lawn, kind of. But I do think there was a little bit of, is Taylor really playing in this arena? Is this right? And I think there were people who felt a little, they wanted to push back on that. And so in this moment, where that arena, I mean, think of how much pop as a whole has changed in the last 3 or 4 years. The kind of huge multinational global corporate pop thing doesn't really exist as much as it did anymore. And so that is starting to be decentralized, and we are all decentralized and destabilized. So Taylor kind of jumping out in front of that and making, in essence, an isolationist album is probably better suited to the mood of the overall moment than those records, Lindsay, that you were sort of talking about, where she was getting this kind of awkward flack for.
Absolutely. I mean, look, Black is King, I feel like my timeline could not be less enthused for whatever that is. And
the Beyonce film you're talking about that's coming out tomorrow. As we record, we're on Thursday, so it comes out tomorrow on Disney Plus. Sponsor the pod.
But I mean, that's like, it just to compare, like, that's two very mega stars doing two very different things. And granted, you know, one project was a year in the making and one was made amidst quarantine. And yet I do think people seem to be sort of exhausted and fatigued with the huge production, right?
Yeah, is that the thing that's, because I was going to say, what do you think that fatigue is about? Because I feel like I pick up on that as well. And I can't quite tell if it's a fatigue about the scale or if it's a fatigue about the dropping in out of nowhere. There's a fatigue that comes with that. What do you think the fatigue is about?
I think it's totally about scale. Look, I love B, but she be playing a little bit fast and loose with the continent. And the diaspora is not totally feeling that right now. And I also think, and this is maybe a little bit too far afield from Taylor, but I also think there is just like sort of celebrity fatigue, or celebrities being celebrities, right? Versus, I don't know, January Jones just like being a loon on Instagram, which is very fun, right?
Yeah, or Martha Stewart posting thirst traps, you know?
Exactly.
And that's, I think that's a fair point. And this is something that we've kind of come back to over and again since the beginning of the quarantine era, which is, it's very unclear what a really famous person, how do they remain famous while not seeming absurd during this particular moment. And, you know, that goes all the way back to the Imagine video where you just are watching this and you're like, what are you guys doing? Like,
even
literally.
That feels like 15 years ago.
I reread my piece about that. And it honestly, you're so, it literally, I've lived and died easily four times since that happened. It was so long ago. And it's interesting because I think the Taylor record is the first pop star album release at scale. But because of the nature of the record, it doesn't quite feel like it's at scale, even though low-key it is. You know, there's 8 different vinyl things you can get. You can buy the cardigan, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe what you're picking up with the Beyonce thing is that feels at scale, and it's not hiding that it's at scale.
Right.
I'll ask the Justin Timberlake question.
I've been waiting. Yes. I have had my flannel on for the last 10 minutes.
My God. I just pulled up the Man of the Woods track listing. I do not remember what these songs sound like. But here's a question. This is from Alina Carroll. Strong open. Not a substantive question, comment. I disagree, actually. But does anyone else feel like this is what Justin Timberlake was trying and failed to do with Man of the Woods? Wait, can we just listen to a song off Man of the Woods, which is a record that I do not know what it sounds like anymore? Sure. Maybe Montana, because that's probably pretty rustic.
Sounds like a song from that album.
Yeah, Montana, really? it's a cool state. Yo, shout out everybody in Billings who I saw when I was in Billings 2 years ago. So shout out y'all. And here's Montana by Justin Timberlake, which is probably a song that offends your state. Okay, so what do we make of Alina's question? Is this what JT was trying to achieve on that record?
The problem is...
We could just leave it. You could just literally stop there. That's it. That's the answer. That's the answer. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
So the issue with saying... The issue with agreeing with saying, yes, you know, Justin Timberlake tried to be... I mean, he was doing like a little bit of a different thing. It was a little bit more Western, a little bit more fringe. Wilderness.
It was aestheticized in a real way.
Yeah. Like Taylor's more like woods. Justin Timberlake's like, I don't know, plains or something like that. But
man of the plains.
But I think the problem with saying that Justin Timberlake failed to make the musical meet the visual, right? Because like that album is full of 808s. It's full of Timberland influences. I mean, he's like popping and locking in the Filthy video. Like that doesn't sound very Man of the Woods or the Plains. But the problem with calling that fake and what Taylor's doing real is that it like sort of essentializes what is essentially a somewhat shallow or at the very least like aesthetic project on both of their behalves. And so I think when we talk about authenticity in music, it starts to get like really sticky. And it's like, what is an authentic indie experience from a artist who just left what is technically an independent label to join like the largest record conglomerate in the world, right? What is it to call that, you know, an album distributed that way, an authentic indie experience, and call what Justin Timberlake was doing not? Neither one of them is living out in the backwoods.
Yeah.
Truly.
I think too, what makes that project feel different than the aim of what Taylor is trying to do here is it's, yes, the aesthetic trappings are, you know, woodsy and plainsy and whatever you want to call it, but it's ultimately a showcase of her strength as a songwriter. And to like the equivalent would be if Justin Timberlake made a really stripped down vocal record, that's his strength is having the voice. And I think this is Taylor reasserting, you know, her lyrical prowess in a lot of ways. I agree, John, with I think how you feel about some of these songs, that I don't know that the production choices always make the most sense for some of the songwriting here. I appreciate a lot of the risks and attempts to do something new that she's taking, but I think ultimately like there is substance to this record that there was not in the woods with JT. Like there's really a lot of meat to some of the what she's doing as a songwriter and trying to put a spotlight back on that.
I have maybe like an even more cynical answer to this question, which is obviously authenticity. That's, you know, it's a sham. It's a fraud. Like it's, you know, it's always that's a fragmented, brittle concept, generally speaking. So let's just assume it was never in play, right? Let's assume everything is calculated. Everything is a marketing choice. Everything is sinister in some way, all choices. When I think about the Man of the Woods era, Justin Timberlake, I think of a pop performer in career free fall, right? I feel like someone who specializes in a form of music, and you can say that's pure pop, that's boy band pop, that's R&B, it's blue-eyed soul, whatever it is. It's black music indebted boy band pop. That's what he specialized in. A sound that is less and less relevant, broadly speaking. He is aging out of the demographic. he has a couple choices. He can make an adult contemporary R&B record. He can make a thick record. He can make a chem record. You know, like, he could choose to go in that direction. But there is something that felt a little cynical about basically being like, I'm going to completely jump off that ship. Although, Lauren, as you point out, there's actually plenty of stuff on that album that doesn't jump that ship. But aesthetically, I'm going to jump and kind of try to get swaddled in another set of aesthetics that maybe will awaken a fan base that's more middle-aged and maybe might resonate with those visuals a little bit more. That cynicism, I think, kind of soaked through that project. Whereas with Taylor, if there's a ploy for credibility or authenticity, it's in a, Lindsay, as you say, you know, it's a little bit of a retreat to OG Taylor songwriting. And it's also her credibility ploy, even though it's aestheticized, is also like, it's, I'm going to make like potentially a slightly weird record with this guy from The National who like doesn't do pop songs. That to me feels a little bit truer, broadly speaking, to the Taylor, what her strengths have been and what her choices have been. It's also worth adding, and we don't really talk about this very much anymore in pop music, but if you go back to the 70s and 80s, like, you'd have pop stars who kind of would do these kind of, you know, shifts from record to record. And, oh, I tried this approach and it didn't work, so then I'm going to go back and try another approach. And, you know, looking back on it 20 or 30 years later, you sort of say, oh, that's so-and-so's Metal Machine music. That's so-and-so's New Wave period, et cetera, et cetera. Because of the immediacy and ahistoricity of kind of contemporary consumption, it's harder and harder to remember that this has always been a thing that inventive, curious pop stars and other musicians have tried.
Yeah, and I think another difference is just that, like, Taylor's album is good. Justin's album was not good. No, yeah, I mean,
that's honestly the answer. We could just cut the whole 10 minutes.
Oh, man. Okay, and that's our show. Thank you so much. Okay, to that question, here's actually two questions that came from two different people that are indirectly related. The first is from Tyler Brown. The question is Gaslighter the best Taylor Swift album of the past week, that being the Chicks album? And in parentheses, a Christopher Nolan-esque album of influenced by Taylor? Fair. The other question, this is from Alyssa Cottarelli. I wonder if that's just Joe commenting under a different name.
Sounds like it.
Would this album be even better without Jack Antonoff? What if Nathan Chapman produced the songs on this album? So these are both kind of like Antonoff-connected questions. Anybody want to jump in on Jack? Okay, wow. Well, just next week, should we just skip to the next questions?
I think if Chapman had been in that role, I think less y'all would have listened to this album. I think it would have been a great album, but I think less of y'all would have listened to it.
Fewer people would have listened to it if Jack did not come to the table with it.
Yes.
Why that?
I don't know, because I think some people are, they seem to be like fake fans, and like, I don't know, it just like didn't, I think a lot of new people have like coalesced around this album in, you know, welcome and thank you. But
a cardigan for everybody. Everybody gets also, a cardigan.
Yes. But it also does seem to be, you know, part of the wave that's, I don't even know. I don't want to call it a wave because that makes it, that, you know, gets into like fandom, whatever. But like our, you know, because he did do, you know, there was the Chicks album and Lord, and there's just some people are talking about it less so because it's Taylor, but because it seems to be part of this pop girl lineage that's like being built through like Antonoff's production credits or like something like that, even though like he credits her for starting that portion of his career.
Lauren, what do you think? Do you listen to Gaslighter?
I love Gaslighter.
You like it. Okay. And do you feel the kind of like, as the person says, a sort of Christopher Nolan-esque kind of like incepted by and also like influenced by and also influencing kind of cycle of life thing with that record with Taylor?
I don't know what the baggage is of that question. Like, I don't know if it's because it's so autobiographical and so, you know, really pinned on the fallout of this one particular relationship that it feels Taylor-esque or something like that. But I do know that I'm kind of like over the era of like psychoanalyzing the lyrics to her song, or not even psychoanalyzing, just like deep like symptomatic readings of the star or the, you know, the main characters of her stories. And I think one of the interesting conversations that's been happening around this album is the idea of Taylor not being the central character in, you know, the folk stories that she's telling. I feel like I just got really defensive. I don't know why I'm so defensive.
Well, let me add one more Antonoff question on top of that. And Lindsay, maybe this will tie it all together. This is from Will Domke. And this is also addressed to about my review, but it's the question's universal. Will says, a lot of your review talks about how Dessner tends to drown the songs in production here. Do you think that the Antonoff songs fared any better? In my opinion, the Antonoff tracks feel very slight and kind of mushy compared to the Dessner tracks, with the exception of Illicit Affairs. Actually, let's listen to Illicit Affairs very briefly.
Leave the perfume on the shelf that you picked out just for him, so you leave no trace behind, like you don't even exist. Take the words for what they are, a dwindling mercurial high, a drug that only worked the first few hundred times. And that's the thing about Illicit Affairs. And
this is, I think, a fair point. I do think the Antonoff songs are relatively mushy. And actually, as compared to the Dixie Chicks songs, I'm sorry, as compared to the Chick songs, I do feel that. and as compared to prior Antonoff Taylor songs, I do actually think that, you know, obviously we don't know like what order things were recorded in, but I wonder if he heard some of what was happening with Dessner and kind of adjusted accordingly. That's a narrative I'm making up, but it could happen.
I think over the last, so since the songs that he worked on, that Jack Antonoff worked on 1989 with, probably most pointedly Out of the Woods, which really has what I think I initially associated as the Jack Antonoff sound, which is just these big 80s drums and big chorus, explosive hook and everything. I think he has gotten stronger as a producer as he's started getting out of his own way and letting the artist really take the reins. I think if you look at the records he's done in the last couple of years, like you mentioned the Lord one, which I think has some of his stamp on it a little bit, but something like the last Lana Del Rey album that really you wouldn't listen to that and think this is the same producer as Taylor Swift's Out of the Woods or as like a Bleachers song or something. And I think he's starting to, the songs that he's making with Taylor feel more like she's, I don't want to say that she's driving it because I like resist that whole producer artist narrative and very, you know, there's a lot of sticky stuff in there, re-agency and everything. But I actually really like the Antonoff songs on this record. And I think for me, the middle section, starting with Mirror Ball, I'm really into those songs and the way they sound. And I think there's also on the last episode, I thought it was funny that Karen brought up like the K Records sound, because that was like a weird, very unexpected reference point that I was getting on this record, which of course is like a very lo-fi bedroom recorded kind of aesthetic that they are on this record recreating in with like the budget that none of those artists ever had, and
yeah,
kind
it's
of
like
trying
the Balenciaga,
to make things.
Yeah, it's the Balenciaga of bedroom recording. Totally. You know what I mean? It's like it's the Dior, it's the Loewe. I'm sorry, I should change that. It's the Loewe of bedroom recordings.
Yeah, and I hear that particularly on the Antonoff songs. I'm just like, as a fan of that type of music and someone who really grew up loving like that aesthetic of indie pop and lo-fi indie rock and stuff, like that is really speaking my language. And that feels like, I know Jack Antonoff has a whole like emo background and everything, so it feels like something that he would be conversant in as a producer. But something else I wanted to bring up with reference to those songs too is Taylor is 30 now. She's a millennial. Millennials are not, it's not a default thing for a young person anymore. Like there's another generation now coming up behind her. And I've noticed that that sound, like I've seen people kind of say that some of the songs on this record sound like Claro or
I haven't seen that, but that's interesting.
Yeah, like Mirrorball in particular. I saw someone tweeting about that. I think if you look at someone like Biba Doobie.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, shout out Biba Doobie.
She's great. These are artists like in their early 20s, very Gen Z. There is an aesthetic of kind of like TikTok indie rocker vibe that I feel like her or Antonoff is like kind of has an antenna up on that and is trying to tap into that a little bit with some of these songs, because I think we also should talk about Taylor does kind of self-consciously seem to be stepping into this role as like the elder, looking back both on her career and in telling these stories about younger people that feels meaningful to me too.
But just to that point, can I ask a question, which is, do you think what you just said vis-a-vis Clairo and Biba Doobie, do you think that extends maybe just a tiny bit outward from there to the Snail Mails of the world, to the Phoebe Bridgers of the world? I feel like I've seen a lot of like Taylor v. Phoebe, not in a negative way, but just a sort of like all of a sudden cohabitating in the same space. Do you feel like it goes there as well?
Yeah, and I think that does have to do with the changing perception of Taylor Swift. Like, I remember, you know, when, I guess during the Red era, it was like a news story on the internet that Grimes played a Taylor Swift song in a DJ set and at Boiler Room, and it was like a scandal. And this is like, we lived through this. This was the same, you know.
Grimes also wore a Dixie Chicks t-shirt, I think, at some point.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering that correctly.
Yeah. So all these things that either seemed like quote unquote uncool before, or that there was some like guilty pleasure aspect of it, I think we've come a long way in terms of taking Taylor and other younger women artists seriously, or at least like calling people out that don't. And I do think that's something that she's kind of playing around with on this record that I want to talk a little bit about too. But I think that there's not that stigma for like a Gen Z, you know, whatever an indie rocker is today, or a singer-songwriter, or like someone like Phoebe Bridgers is like giving Taylor props on Twitter, and that no one's like writing a Pitchfork news story about it. It's just like expected now. So
do
I think,
do you think it even gets into the Slack at Pitchfork, or do you think everybody's like, finally, it's our time?
I think if she like said something bad about Taylor Swift, it would now. Like the what is cool in terms of like the perception of her has totally shifted in the past 10 years. And I think that that is something that Taylor is very aware of and is kind of having a little bit of fun with on this record, with some of those songs where she's looking back and making references to being 17 or being, you know, singing about high school students from this slight level of remove now. And I'm curious, like, how those songs land for you guys, too, because they feel different to me.
I also think it's worth keeping in mind that, like, she has her, not everyone has the entire narrative, I guess you could say, or like has been here the whole time, which I think is what you're saying, and brings all of that to her music now. Not everyone has been here since before Fearless. I mean, Fearless was my, people are doing like that, like, oh, four high school albums or whatever. Fearless was like one of those for me in high school. It was on repeat. It did not stop. I think the young people who are coming to the album also, you know, yeah, like you're saying, I mean, they're not necessarily reading so much into it, or they're reading something different into it, or it might just be a cool piece of music that finds affinity with the other things that they're listening to.
Also, and Lindsay, to your point, music like a Phoebe Bridgers, think about the Phoebe Bridgers equivalent of like the early to mid 90s, right? It's super niche. It's seen. It's hard to access unless you are reading the zine / at the show / have a cool older sister who's into it. You know, it's a little bit tough to reach. In 2020, Phoebe Bridgers right there on Spotify, best new music, just like everybody else. And so all those kind of indie, quote unquote, signifiers that we used to think of that were essentially business issues, you know, they were business constructions. They don't exist, certainly nowhere near at the intensity that they used to.
Which is also why I don't buy the whole idea that because the National and Bon Iver are a part of this record, that it somehow is indie. Like, I don't think of those two artists as indie anymore either, whatever that means. Like, they're quasi household names. They're Grammy winners. Like, they're
not, you know, in my house.
Check it at the door.
Oh, no, well, Bon Iver is fine. National, different thing.
Yeah, yeah, same. I also should disclose, I've never really connected with their music. And, you know, it's funny to me that just because those names are thrown in the mix, we're talking about it as her indie record. Whereas, again, I think if you really are going to throw that word around, I think some of the Antonoff songs and the actual sound of just sort of shoegazy indie pop 90s kind of Mazzy Star vibes, that's where I get it from. Not so much like looking at the track list to see who was working on this song. It's more the sound. But even then, it's not, what do any of these things mean?
Well, and she's clearly, like, she's upstreaming Dessner more than Dessner is subculturing her. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's fair. And if we now have 2 to 3 years of Dessner-produced pop albums, like a la Antonoff-produced pop albums, the reckoning of that, I'm going to be interested to see. Okay, we'll do a few lightning round short ones. From Trevor Kelly Stevens, is this album, okay, so this is based on a false premise, this question. Is this album going to force John to finally give a favorable take on Bon Iver, or will he forever live in darkness? Now, Trevor, I may forever live in darkness. That is unconnected to what I think about Bon Iver, but I happen to really like Bon Iver. And if you read the Times Magazine story that I wrote about him during the For Emma period, you'll see that I quite like Bon Iver. I spent 2 or 3 days with him in Wisconsin. I like most of the music. I don't like the later music as much as I like the earlier music, but I am very into Bon Iver. This, to the point that you just made, Lindsay, Marta Lukin says, can we clarify that this album is not a folk album? What do you think?
I don't think it is. I don't know. I don't put it into a genre necessarily. And
have people been calling it folk? I feel like no one's called it folk.
Yeah.
And like, and maybe, I mean, it's called folklore. Like, there's a whole word there. So I don't think she's trying to say it. I don't think she's trying
to
say
it. You're like, read the whole word. Read, yeah. It's right there. There's four other letters.
Too long, didn't read the whole word.
Yeah, it's TLDR the time. I feel like when I was thinking in my review of kind of how to address the genre, I didn't find anything satisfying. Like, I think I probably used indie rock once or twice, but even Karen and I, we talked about it. We didn't feel great about it. I was sort of thinking about, like, you know, art folk or composed folk or something like that. I didn't use that, but that was kind of, I was toying with that. And as I was listening to the album again today, it doesn't really feel like any of those things. It just feels like a kind of, like a suppressed Taylor Swift record, whatever that means.
Is chamber pop still a thing?
Shouts at Regina Spektor? You mean,
yeah,
that kind of?
I guess. Yeah. I think I never really understood what that phrase meant either, but I'm just going to
put it out there.
I think so many genre things are meaningless. And I think she's finally understanding that too. I think what also kind of put some people off about the 1989 era was how self-consciously she was like, this is my pop album. And it's, you know, better than the mindless kind of pop. It's the good pop. And there just were, you know, I think putting herself within those bounds doesn't let her explore all of her strengths. And I'm glad she's kind of letting up on that a little bit. I do wish there was just like more kind of a dynamic range on this album. Sorry, I'm totally derailing the lightning round by just...
No, but this actually feeds... Can I actually ask the next question? Because I does kind of feed into, I think, where you're about to go.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so this is from Sophie Rose Zucker. And Sophie, I apologize. When I cut and paste, I cut off half your question, but I can kind of tie it together. So Sophie says, Taylor's songwriting has always been very distinctive. You can usually expect a twist, in quotes, or inversion in the last chorus of a story, and she loves a very evocative bridge. While there are echoes of her regular style here, ... you know, so what Sophie's saying is ultimately those kind of structural things that are Taylor things have also been thinned out or recalibrated on this record. And maybe that to me is actually maybe the most astute lyrical structural reading on what's new or unusual about this record. I sort of tried to talk about in the review about how the production seems to be working at odds with her melodies, but it is also kind of dismantling her structural stuff. And I do think maybe, Lindsay, this ties into where you're about to go.
there are a few songs that have, you know, quote unquote, the twist that if you think about, like, one of her first big songs was Our Song that has that famous little songwriting twist at the end. She does sort of love that kind of a flourish. And Last Great American Dynasty has that when she's suddenly, like, inserts herself into the narrative. And Betty kind of has that too. I do think, like, that
the most 2006 songs on the record, to be fair.
Yes. Yeah. Which is interesting in and of itself. But I think it kind of gets to that point about how she is looking backward. I mean, to go back to the title and the idea of folklore and kind of think there's a song about, like, passing something down, like a folk song, which sort of makes sense, I guess. But maybe that's where people are getting the folk idea, but or misnomer. But I think that she's interacting with her past and her legacy in a way that feels pretty mature to me, and kind of looking back at, you know, again, these songs that are about teenagers. I think she got a lot of flack in the past for being a woman in her 20s, still sort of operating at that teenage register, whatever that means. And I think for me, like, the biggest leap in songwriting on this record is how that feels, something has shifted, where I think the sort of harbinger from Lover that I think I most hear on this record is the song Miss Americana, which is all about this teenage drama, and that she's singing from the perspective of still being there. And that song has grown on me a lot. I didn't really like it the first time I heard Lover, and I've since, like, really come around on it. But I think she's finding a way to look back on those teenage emotions that she was so good at capturing the drama of in her early songs, and finding a way to not necessarily, like, embody them and being a teenager herself, but tell these crafted stories that do honor the extremes of those feelings and the, you know, all the lines about, I knew everything when I was young from Cardigan. Like, she is asserting that, no, maybe those stories are worth taking seriously and were all along, even when I was singing them. So I do think she's found a way to look back with a certain amount of distance, but also still, like, a song on, like, Betty, really step into it in, like, a visceral way that feels satisfying and brings you back to being a teenager. Also not a lightning round answer. I have a lot of thoughts about this.
It's much less exuberant, which doesn't mean necessarily less serious or less in lockstep with those kind of feelings that she's reminiscing about. Like, I think it's very funny that on TikTok, which, you know, I'm not on TikTok, like, I don't know how to get there, whatever, but I do know that there is this, like, TikTok trend with Love Story. I think that's the song. And you, like, you think about that song and how driving it is, and it's so, and, like, the fantasy of that song, and then there's that twist at the end, you know, he, you know, I'm not gonna sing, but, like, he knelt to the ground, like, blah, 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 all that. And, like, compare that to, like...
Wait, can you just sing it, though? Just
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, totally. But I think that is one way to talk about teenage love. And Betty is quite another. But it's all Taylor.
Speaking of Taylor lyrical evolution, this is a question that came in via email. And unfortunately, I deleted the header of the email. So I apologize in advance. I don't know who sent it offhand. What do you think of all the expletives? Five songs on the album are explicit, with at least two that say more than once. Never thought the NYT would have to bleep out a Taylor lyric, but here we are in 2020 where that might be the case. Hey, Pedro, maybe let's play a little bit of Mad Woman and we'll see if it bleeps or not.
What do you sing on your drive home? Do you see my face in the neighbor's lawn? Does she smile? What does she mouth? You forever. Every time you call me crazy.
I'm old enough to remember when it was novel, you know, you'd hear Taylor sing about having a drink on a record, and you'd be like, oh my God, she's thinking about having a drink. You'd have these little milestone moments, and then that started to be fatiguing because you just sort of, I don't want to measure a person by these kind of arbitrary external milestones that really have nothing to do with creativity or art. But, you know, was I a little bit like, oh, when I heard on this record a couple times? Yeah, I think I was. But I, you know, Taylor's 30. She's allowed. What do you guys think?
I love it. I love everything
you're,
about it.
You're here for it.
I love when pop stars curse. I remember when Beyonce started cussing.
Yes.
I remember when, you know, Rihanna, I mean, you know, she's always been, you know, whatever, bad girl, but like, I just love when, like, especially on like slower songs or ballads or moodier songs. So maybe not like an angry song, but just like a deep, like, you know, like a or whatever. I don't know. I don't know if we're supposed to go.
Nah, just, we lost. We're off the rails. That's fine.
But I mean, it was like an invitation, right? I think it's so great. Love Taylor working Blue. Love to see it.
Mm. Yeah, I too love, especially a female pop star, like finally cursing for, like, I remember the first Beyonce, like Lemonade, like she just sounded so liberated and it was beautiful having held herself back for so long. And I kind of feel that way about Taylor on this record. Although I love how in Betty, which I think is one of the F-bombs that she drops, it's sort of within the context of like teenagers talking, where she's like, "If would you tell me to go f- myself?" And
yeah, right, it's like a little bit of a cheat.
Yeah,
it's like a tiny cheat.
It's been my dream to be bleeped on podcast, by the way. So another one to
all,
check out.
We all getting bleeped. Everybody getting bleeped in 2020. It's great.
But I like how she's sort of asserting, like, you know, this is how young people talk. Like, I talked this way. She's quoting like a teenage protagonist when she says that. And I think it is, if you want to read a lot into it, just a way of kind of saying like, this is how people talk. It's not a big deal, but I'm any sort of liberation for Tay Tay. I'm here for it.
Do you think Taylor as an actual teenager cursed a lot?
No.
Well, there's a question. And the reason I bring it up is there's a question. This is from Gabby Iorio. It's about something that Joe has said, and also I think I have said in different contexts, which is Joe still going to be calling for justice for Liz Rose, who obviously was a co-writer on a bunch of the early Taylor stuff. But in the context of Taylor having arrived at saying, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I love the Liz Rose stuff, but I'm so content with Taylor being post Liz Rose, tightly wrapped, super, super sealed up, stitched up melodies, you know, with a veneer, a sheen of innocence around them.
Here's like a thought experiment, but do you think when she re-records the masters of all previous albums, she'll like add a little bit of swearing in where, cause there are Taylor songs where I've almost like felt her, there's like a beat for it where I've almost felt her like wanting to just go there.
Wow.
If she wasn't going to do it, she's definitely going to do it now that you put that out in the world.
Hi, Taylor.
Wow. Wow.
It would be cool.
Do you think she's going to re-record? Do you guys think she's going to re-record the records?
I still don't know. But I still just love the threat of it looming. It's like the most Taylor Swift thing to me, and I adore it.
Lauren, what do you think?
It sounds like a lot of work to me. I get it. Like, stakes are high. Money, whatever. It's just like, gosh. And also just to step back into that, like, I can't, like, what, you know, what kind of memories she has of, like, the Fearless album, of Red, of, like, just to, like, step back into, like, the muck and the mire of, like, whatever you were feeling, even as you, like, put out this, like, beautiful thing. But I don't know, she's a businesswoman, who it's knows
true. I mean, but it's just like, is it like, you know, like retyping your old book, you know, or your old articles or something? Like, I don't know, it's hard to know. I wouldn't find that gratifying personally, but
I will also say, well, I'm not gonna sing either, but All Too Well is one of my karaoke standards. Shout out to Liz Rose again. And I have multiple times when I have sung that song added an F-bomb that I think should be there I have sang the line, wow, this thing was a masterpiece till you f***ed it all up, which I think should be the lyric when you really think about the emotion being conveyed in that song. So again, just putting that out there to the universe.
I would love to hear on the Facebook group or on the email, I'd love to know Taylor Swift lyrics that you think should have curses, that or that there are beats for curses. If you think such a lyric exists, get on the Facebook group and start a thread. I want to see that. Okay, let's do the last question. And this is a little bit big picture. And actually, Lauren, you know, you're talking about Beyonce a little bit earlier. This kind of ties in with that. And it's something I mentioned in the review. This is from Sally O'Dunlang. Is this Taylor's Beyonce moment where she abandons chart success? And by chart success, I assume she means largely of individual songs in a kind of micro way, in favor of fully embracing her future as an albums artist. Because, Lauren, as you were saying, like, Beyonce is kind of its place where the scale is the thing. It's like once a year, once every 18 months, I'm just going to arrive with like the semi and we're just going to come with this big thing. But also Beyonce doesn't really have, she's not like a radio hit maker in the current sense. Not right, right this minute. So is Taylor potentially moving in that direction? And if so, does it really matter? You know, there were a bunch of questions of like, how do you tour this album? Are any of these albums going to be singles on, you know, like in classic radio sense? All of that ties into this, which is Taylor's future more in super serving the millions and millions and millions of Taylor Swift fans that already exist, rather than kind of like fragmenting out and being like, well, it'd be great if we were on pop radio. It'd be great if we were on country radio. It'd be great if we were on adult radio, et cetera.
Well, we started off by talking about it as sort of a transitional album. And so not to skirt the question, to the extent that it is transitional, we can't know. I mean, of course we can't know, but I also like, can't even venture to guess because it doesn't feel like she's, like, merch aside, it doesn't feel like she's landing in this. Like, it doesn't feel like she's gonna, like, you know, wade in this, like, vaccine tomorrow, tour tomorrow. It doesn't feel like she would tour with this, and not because it's not because she doesn't perceive it as like a tourable album or a body of work, but just because it's like it, you know, it's not the thing. I don't know if it's the thing.
I like almost would like it to be the exact opposite where, or not the exact opposite, but Beyonce is so good at just huge gestures and bombast and all of this dramatic imagery and everything. I think this record reasserts that Taylor's strength is in this feeling of intimacy and smallness and how much she can do in that space and how much power she holds in that space. And I think that's part of why, like, I would love this to be a transition for her to do, like, an all-acoustic album. Not to, I know she's never going to make, like, the country album again. It's fine. But I think what is so powerful, like, it seems like Betty is a consensus favorite on this record. It's a great song. I think part of what is so powerful about it is I think it's the sparsest production and arrangement on the whole record, and it really stands out in that way because it's, I don't know if it's her playing the guitar, but it's just guitar, harmonica, voice,
a little bit of stuff. We got a question about the harmonica, about like basically like where were you when you first heard the Betty harmonica, which I think is a totally legit question.
I think I guessed.
I felt like I almost fell off the couch, you know, like I scrambled to the credits because that was like the first that I was immediately like, who's playing, what's going on here, like go on.
So, but yeah, I would love it to be, I think, again, what I was going to say before of just the, when I would like some more dynamism and contrast on this record, I think Betty provides that, like part of why it's such a standout at the end of the album is it just kind of pops after all of the somewhat drony, hypnotic production. It's just a return to a girl on her guitar and harmonica and telling a story. Like there's something almost like Springsteen about it. And I would love for her to kind of even strip it back further now and do something like that. Cause I think there's so much power in her locking into that mode and the way people are responding to that song in particular seems to show that she still can do that.
My answer to this question about albums artists is in essence, yes. I don't think you'll see Taylor chasing sort of like quasi-contemporary pop hits anymore. That's not to say she'll never have pop hits again, but I do think they are going to come from a place of kind of along the lines of what you're talking about, Lindsay, which is, you know, she'll make an album that maybe it's an all-acoustic album, maybe it is a country-themed album, maybe, you know, it will have some kind of position that's self-contained, and something might emanate outwards from there to broader consciousness. But I do think ultimately being in the business of delivering Taylor Swift content to Taylor Swift fans is plenty lucrative and a hell of a way to spend your 30s. Lauren, Lindsay, what a gem. Very psyched for you guys to be here. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Let's listen to a little bit of Peace.
And you know that I'd swing with you for the fences, sit with you in the trenches, give you my wild, give you a child, give you the silence that only comes when two people understand each other. Family that I chose, now that I see you, brother, as my brother. Is it enough?
But there's robbers to the east. This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sex espionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets, and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in LA, binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
Hi, it's Samantha Shea from Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. We all know those people who are simply impossible to shop for. At Wirecutter, we have a huge collection of gift guides to help you find the perfect present. We can help you find a gift for the indoorsy type, a gift for the coffee lover looking to try a new bean, something that's nice but not too nice for the new person you're seeing, the best packing cubes for frequent travelers, for the music-loving dad, try a Thelonious Monk album. We believe there's a perfect gift for everyone, and Wirecutter can help you find it. Check out all our gift guides at nytimes.com/giftguides.
Jill, how are you feeling?
You know, it's been the longest week of my life and the strangest week of my life. Yeah. So I think right now I'm doing okay. It has been like a weird processing. So I feel like I'm kind of on the other side of it.
You feel sturdy right now?
Yeah. Versus like 2 days ago, I felt a little tender and a little like fearful in a delayed sort of way. When it first happened, I was like, no one's coming to my house. And then I think I texted you that on Monday. I was like, no one's coming here.
Right.
And then as time has gone by, I think it's a natural inclination when so much of our job is on the internet and is like compartmentalizing this kind of feedback as it doesn't matter. It's inconsequential. So it took me like, it really hit me on Tuesday night, what had happened and the gravity of it.
So just for clarity, if you're just figuring this out, Jill Mapes is here. Jill's from Pitchfork. Jill and I both received a deep reserve of toxicity on the internet this week in response to our reviews of the Taylor record. Jill's review. Actually, Jill, I thought your review was super, super well written. Like really just very astute. Like really like I felt like I agreed with it in everything, but like I just didn't like it as much as you did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But like all the structural stuff, like I was like, I agree with it.
Thank you.
Both of us received just a tremendous amount of hostility. Doxing, falsified information. There's like some fake Photoshop tweet going around. There's just a lot of terrible, terrible stuff by rabid fans who I guess want Taylor to have a perfect Metacritic score. I don't totally get it, but I think it's that. And music is not a competition. There's no prize. I mean, I guess being the number one album is a prize, but you know what I mean? Like there's not really a prize. And it's possible to like a record without threatening to hex a person who likes the record less.
Yeah. The thing that's so crazy to me is that they care so much about a Metacritic score, but they don't actually care about criticism. And they don't also understand that Metacritic isn't, at least my side of things, no one has checked that in like 8 years. Like
it's so funny you say that because I kept seeing tweets that were tagged to me and tagged to Metacritic, like, hey, Metacritic, like, don't count this or whatever. And I was like, I know what Metacritic is, but I just don't know that I have ever once looked at Metacritic. like ever in life.
Yeah. The only reason I ever used to use it was because they had a pretty decent like upcoming releases calendar.
Oh,
that was okay. The only reason to use it is like a shortcut in my job, but it's not a corollary in my mind to like Rotten Tomatoes where people actually look at it before you watch a movie.
Right.
I just think music is so different. You put on a song, you see if you like it. It's like, I don't know. I don't want to debate whether we even need criticism, because if you think that, then you think, oh, what's the use? You can just listen to it. But like, it has a very different role. And I think the way they're approaching Metacritic is just so illogical, personally.
Well, it's like the one, I guess it's the one numericized place on the internet where you can go. I mean, obviously besides Billboard and streaming numbers, but in terms of like for critic reaction, it's the only real meta numericized place. So I think maybe it carries like an unusual burden for people who are new to criticism, you know, or it sort of like seems like outsized in terms of its importance. I don't know. It's tough to say, but what I do know is that, look, I've been through some maelstroms on the internet.
Yeah, I'm sure. I've seen it.
Yeah, you know, sometimes by my fault and many times not by my fault. But this was, in its density, its relentlessness, in its rancor, and in its cruelty, this was maybe the worst. And you don't want to say like, oh, I wouldn't think Taylor Swift would have such toxic fans, because like everybody has that, you know, like you probably have a toxic fan. Maybe have a toxic fan. Like, you know, like there's not necessarily like a correlation between the fan and the artist. But I will say it is very shocking every time it happens to me. And this was like the most intense time. Like every time it happens, it remains shocking to me the depths of hostility that people will access in the name of a famous person who maybe doesn't know, or maybe doesn't notice, or maybe does. I mean, you know, I don't know, but just in the name of a famous person. In my most sympathetic mode, you know, I remember what it was like to be a teenager and to be really a fan of something, like a real booster of something. And I didn't have the tools. I didn't have Twitter. I didn't have internet databases to hack.
You know, same. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so I hope that I would have been responsible in my fandom if I did have those tools, but I'm trying to be like a tiny bit sympathetic, because there were like even some tweets were sort of like, you're biased. You should be basically biased in the other direction. And I was sort of like, that's a proto-critical conversation that you're having with me, even if you're not framing it as such. So maybe there's like a spark of hope somewhere in there, but like it's just cluttered by all the other stuff.
Yeah. And the thing that I keep coming back to is like, it's really easy to be angry when this sort of thing happens to you. And I definitely went through that in processing this, like when I fully sat with the fact that they had leaked a photo of my house and my address, like more than a phone number or emails, like that really shook me. But the thing that I keep coming back to is like, I'm sure the person who did it is like 16 and lives very far away and thinks of me as an idea, as an oppositional idea to their favorite instead of an actual person. And part of why I wanted to come talk to you is to say, like, I'm a real person, I'm a vulnerable person, and I've been in this industry for 10 years, and this has affected me in a way that no feedback has ever affected me in my actual life before.
I was thinking a lot this week, partially because of what happened with the Swifties and partially just with some other stuff. I was thinking a lot about, this is a slightly bad comparison, so you'll allow it in advance. But I was thinking about the difference between John Caramonica the person and like John Caramonica in quote marks, right? And those are not the same thing. And I sometimes will look at something about myself on the internet and I will feel like it's about me as a person, but I sort of understand it's about me as like there's a caricature of me. And that's very hard. Like, I also am a sensitive, vulnerable person. It's very hard to think that someone is out there associating me with this caricatured idea. And I often have an instinct like, oh, like I can fix that. Like, why don't we just talk? Like, I can DM you or I'll send you an email and like, we'll chat about it. And that's, you know, look, maybe sometimes that works, but my venture to say most time it doesn't work, because that's inconvenient for me to be a full person. It's much more convenient narratively and rhetorically for me to be a caricature. This is the part of the analogy that's like a little bit extreme, but like, so I was thinking about Drake.
Oh, God. Don't bring him into this.
No.
Where are you going? Okay, where are you
it's
going?
Look, it's about Drake. It's about Taylor. It's about everybody, right? But it's like at a certain point in public-facing life, I imagine every person, no matter how famous they are, they had a moment not unlike what we are experiencing. They received hostility based on something that was like not totally endemic to them. And they had to accept at a certain point that like, oh, this person, these people, whatever it is, are going to think this thing about me and I can't shake it. I have to like weather it. I can't shake it. I don't like that. I don't think that's how it should be. I don't think that certainly the Twitter protection mechanisms for harassment are extremely insufficient.
Ugh, yeah.
I think we both saw that this week.
I've seen one tweet that I reported taken down.
Woefully underuseful.
Oh, yeah.
And when I think of like the routine amount, I mean, look, this is me having a bad week with the Swifties. When I think of like the routine harassment, women get on the internet, people of color get on the internet, Black writers, I know it's like a drop in the bucket. And I'm mindful of that. But the idea that like, even this one bad week with me being none of those things and in a position of having access to some resources, still found it deeply traumatizing and also unsolvable. The entire thing is fucked.
No, it's true. And people, the strange critical debate broke out that I'm really curious of your thoughts on as somebody who's been a critic for so long and has reviewed so many big albums that, and thus endured stuff like this to some extent, is like people being like the big sites just shouldn't review these pop records, or they should review them way after the fact, or they should write an essay on them and not give them a score. And it's like, I disagree with that because I think there's so much fun and enjoyment and interest in writing about this stuff. Like, this is like my dream assignment as a writer, as a person that loves writing about mainstream culture, to be honest with you, and how weird stuff gets into mainstream culture, that I'm like, this is the perfect assignment for me, that I would never, I just think that's a weird argument. There's a lot of other like convo going on around like critics being threatened, but yeah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a, like, I there's no way I agree with that. I'm concerned. I texted something to someone the other day because it's sort of on this theme. Fear of Twitter combined with the decreasing distance between the famous and the rest of us are the two great threats to the survival of criticism as we know it. Now, you might make the case that maybe criticism as we know it is not worth saving. That's a separate argument, like as a practice. But assuming we are trying to protect criticism as a practice, and just for those who are totally unfamiliar, we mean writing your opinions about music. We don't mean being negative. We mean you can be write positive criticism or negative criticism or mixed criticism, but criticism as a job. If there's a conversation to be had about whether criticism as a practice should no longer exist, I think that's probably wrong, but that's a conversation to have. But certainly, I think if it's going to exist, the idea that like Pitchfork should not review the Taylor Swift album, whether it's for fear of Twitter or because the Pitchfork historically did not pay much attention to Taylor and then now does, like, all opinions are on the table. Like, a thing that I sometimes will say to somebody when they disagree with my opinion is I'm like, that's healthy. I'm glad to know that. And I'm actually pretty sure there's probably another writer who maybe would say the thing that you think. And if it makes you feel like more in tune to read that writer, that's okay. I'm actually the opposite. I love to read reviews that I don't agree with. I want to see how somebody's mind works who doesn't see things or hear things the way that I do. That's why I was really into your review, because I was like, okay, I'm seeing all like the gears work. We didn't land in the same place, but like I'm happy to see like how you pachinko'd it to get to that place. I mean,
same with you. Fully same with you. Like, I saw the flaws in that record, and for me, I was able to get wrapped up in the whimsy of it, or like the world building and the things that were different, the splashes into different writing modes. And I definitely feel like I looked at it almost like editor hat first rather than like musically coming back into it kind of thing. And I read what you wrote, and you're totally coming at it from a different way of thinking about, I feel like, sound first and like where she's been in history. And there's such clear following of everything she's done and knowledge in that review. And we can have a totally, I don't think we have totally different takes, I would say, compared to some of the people that were like, I think this is the greatest thing ever. We're more close than that.
It also doesn't help. Like, that's the other thing. It's like, I don't write criticism because I'm trying to change anything. I'm writing criticism because I've been writing about music for a very long time. I have like a fair amount of historical perspective about this artist in specific and music more broadly. And I like to use criticism to like locate things in history, not simply to just be like thumbs up, thumbs down. Yeah. You want to locate them in history, both the artist's history and also in broader genre and musical history. I sometimes think, and I mentioned this on last week's episode, it's like when you start seeing reviews go up at 1 a.m, right when the record drops, and people are like, it's a masterpiece. I'm not even disputing that it's a masterpiece. You know, like, it could be. But like, do you know that in an hour? Do you know that in 3 hours? You probably not. And that's not helpful. I'm saying that's ultimately, that's not helpful to the big thing. When we look back, we're going to be like, huh, it's weird. There were like 20 masterpiece reviews and they all came out like within 3 hours of each other. That's strange. We're going to look back on that and be like, ah, it doesn't feel right.
Well, isn't that the thing? Like, that's the thing we talk about in my office. Like, you know, reviews are, I feel like we give stuff space, but if we're doing like other works of critical assessments, that I feel like that's always the thing we talk about is like, if it's really that good and incredible that you just know it, like it's like, you know, Fiona Apple level, it would be more possible to write something in a day. But if you're 99% of albums, it's just, you're doing it a disservice because the first three times you listen to something, at least for me, I'm just trying to get the shape of the thing and the mood of it. And
exactly,
you have to listen so many times with different lenses. Like, I'm listening for lyrics, or I'm exactly listening right. for influences, or I'm listening for feel. So it's just like, I don't know how you get the different dynamics to evaluate everything on those individual levels when you have, I mean, I will say in the defense of the folks that published like right after it came out, I heard some people got
advances, yeah, undoubtedly. You
know. But it's a day.
It's within 12 hours.
Right.
Look, I've had records. I mean, not to be all like, I'm old, but like in the 90s, you know, you'd have records for 2 months.
Yeah.
You know, and even more recently, I've had big name records from artists of this nature for 3 days, 5 days, sometimes a day. But like, yeah, it helps. But I still think I would like to see more patience in criticism, broadly speaking. And again, it's not to like indict any of our peers. These are structural issues. This is like SEO. This is like the tyranny of SEO, you know? So like, it's not to indict any individual, but I would like to also encourage the people who are in charge of those things to value the patience that's required for good criticism. And also a reminder to our fellow critics that like, look, this week it was me and it was you. Some other week it could be somebody else. And I don't think we should all be doing our jobs kind of in perpetual, like, is this the week where someone's going to put my phone number on the internet?
Well, right. And I think the point you made about kind of like, it kind of gets into a little bit of a zone that I feel about, like, when people take no money for their writing, it's worse for the entire, like, group of people who call themselves writers. Like, I don't want to say the people that did an instant take are, like, worse for criticism, because the people who did that are critics I respect hugely and love.
No doubt.
And they have tons of knowledge on Taylor. And I think they brought things to the conversation that I'm grateful that they got out there early on. It almost allows you to write a different review 2 days
and
later.
Some of that writing is very good. Like, you know, again, it's not to knock it. And I've done no end of that writing. You know, yeah, like, there's plenty of instantaneous reviews that I've written. Like, it's not a knock on any individual.
No, but it is, like, to me, when you think about it large scale and you go like, maybe we need to all get together and not be against each other and have a little convo that's like, hey, this is bad for criticism on point. Like, it's just, the writing maybe is not bad because the writers are good enough to pull it off. But like, wouldn't the writing be all that more better if they had had The Weeknd or something like that? And people are free to do what they want in their organizations. I know how it is with pressure and traffic and everything you said. It's just like, yeah, I strongly feel that too.
Right. But I just want, I guess what I want to like double down on and share with the people who I know, you know, you've got a lot of support on the internet this week. I've gotten a lot of support. I didn't tweet about it like you did, but like, you know, anybody who looked at my mentions knew what was going on. You know, I got a lot of support privately. I think we should all be having a conversation, and that includes not just like the sites that we work for, the publications that we work for. That includes the people who work with artists. That includes people who, you know, have access to Stan Army activations. Like, this is not a healthy way to have a free speech ecosystem. I think that we all collectively are capable of a better level of discourse. That's how I feel. I feel like all the participants in this are capable of a better level of discourse. And my main reason for wanting to talk to you today is to, number one, let you know that you have support. You have support from me. You have support from everyone I work with. We know what a traumatic time it was. We experienced it too. And also just to say, like, we're still going to be doing what we do because what we do has value and has merit. And we should be able to do it without fear of our safety being jeopardized.
Completely, completely. And thank you. And like, I have really appreciated your support this week. And I've really appreciated so many of our peers' support. And I know that this is like people, I mean, I was heartened when I saw other critic communities picking it up. I know film critic Twitter were like, had gotten screenshots of some things I had tweeted while private, and they were trying to reckon with how fucked up it was. And sorry, Pedro. They were trying to reckon with how messed up it was. And I saw their support, even though they had no idea who I was, because they support the us not being censored. And this is really what that is. I don't want to be too sanctimonious, but when stans come at you and try to silence you, if you're not a strong critic, if you're a young writer, you have no protection. If you're a freelancer, I could fully understand how you would go, I'm just going to interview artists, or I'm just going to review stuff that I know I like. And that's how we end up with an ecosystem where there are no critical reviews, which is a problem, is an actual problem.
I agree. And I honestly don't know. I think if I was, you know, 23 or 24 and had absorbed everything that I absorbed this week, I don't know. You know,
I know.
I'm very rarely thrilled to be middle-aged, but in this case, I think it was probably the only thing that really got me through the week is like just having a sense of history and perspective, and also like seeing like an injustice happen in real time and being like, well, that's not how it should be. And I'm not going to stand for that.
There's so many things on the spectrum of attacks on critics that range from like the artist initiating it a la Lizzo or something like this, where it's the fan groups working like totally without, like, it seems like the type of thing Taylor wouldn't want them to do, considering she's talked about bullying in her career. So I would say that's probably not what she'd want, but like, that's the spectrum of this now. And that has changed. And that's, to me, what this week has shown me is like, you can be positive about something and it still not even matter. It doesn't matter if the artist eggs it on. It's gotten to a point where like people are, the stands are, they don't understand how their actions actually have consequences for the people on the other end. Or if they do, then they're like, sociopathic, frankly.
Well, we're not going to go out on a Taylor Swift song. But Jill, I'm glad you're well. I'm sorry for the week that you had.
Dude, right back at you. Like, I didn't even get to ask you, like, how are you? We kind of just went into it. So, like,
you know, it's, look, I like you. Like I said, the first Sunday was rough and Monday was rough. I was fortunate to have a lot of support institutionally from people in the building who were being helpful as far as reporting tweets and things of that nature. I think what I was saying earlier about the John Caramonica versus John Caramonica in quotes, like, I kind of started to dissociate a little bit. And I thought it's not like the healthiest thing to do, but it was also like kind of the only way I can get through. Cause I knew that like out there, someone was like burning an effigy of me for not liking Folklore as much as I like Reputation. And I'm just like, well, I guess you can burn that effigy. Cause like, you know, I'm still here. So like, I guess that's okay. But like, obviously, no, it's not okay. But you know, it's here it is. It's Friday. I got my Gatorade Zero. I'm, you know, just doing the best I can. But I appreciate you asking.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jill, stay well. Stay critically acute.
You too. I'm trying.
I appreciate that. Like, I wrote a thing. It was actually something I was going to write last week before I knew the Taylor record was coming. I was sort of like, well, what am I going to write at the end of the week? And there's this kid on TikTok who's like just super soothing. And I was like, oh, I'm going to write about this very soothing kid on TikTok. And then the whole Taylor announced and I was like, okay, well, today's not the day for me to do this, blah, blah, blah. So then I did the Taylor thing and then all the listening and da, da, da. And then I got Doc, all these things sort of happened. And then yesterday I was like, I should probably write about the soothing kid.
Yeah, that's definitely a good next assignment choice there. Yeah. Yeah.
So actually, yeah, let's just go out with like a little touch of Larry Scott on TikTok.
Oh, nice.
That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever. nytimes.com/podcast. Get on the Facebook group. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. And subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. That is Google Play, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, etc., etc. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back very soon.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Hey, beat him up.
Oh, nice. Itachi. Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.